Welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for January 28th. It's brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and with me is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Oh, not too much. I am chilling with a capital C tonight. It's cool. It's temperate here in Tokyo at the end of January.
You know, there's still snow on the ground in front of my apartment that just won't melt. The sun doesn't hit it, and it's just frozen.
That's because you're too cool for school, babe.
And I'm too cold for anything right now, except a hot bath. All right, okay. Well, we've got a great show for you this week. It features an interview with Greg Boomer Wells, and then we're going to talk about the recent trade that went down, and then we're going to talk about the WBC and answer a listener question. So the bases are full. Let's get started.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so the great Boomer Wells sat down with me recently, and we talked for a while. It was great to have him on the show. I had a lot of questions for him prepared, and I had to put him away and just let him do the talking because he had lots of stories, and he just took over. It was beautiful. It was great. I'm excited for you guys to listen to this interview. In his career, I think he played 10 years. And he batted .317 in his career with 277 home runs. And I saw somewhere, I think it was Wikipedia or someplace, it said he had 279, but I think officially it's 277.
Correct.
And he had 901 RBIs, and he played with the Hankyu/Oryx franchise for 9 years and then spent a year with Daiei. And he actually had a pretty productive final season. The batting average was below 300, but he played pretty well.
Well, he had a bunch of home runs at that time. I think they were still playing at Heiwada Ice Stadium, which was a real good home run hitter, home run park, and it was outdoors, and it's Fukuoka, so it's hot. So, yeah, he didn't do anything basically but hit home runs, but it was a good season. He played 129 games, so, you know, give him credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, he hit .271. He didn't get on base that much, and he had 97 runs batted in, but I think back in that time, in that era, they wanted a little bit more from a foreign guy, and he was getting up there in age, so, you know, it happens. But it was a pretty productive final season. Now, we talked after the interview, and he gave me some other tidbits of information. He said he's the only guy in MPB history to have 40 or more home runs and fewer than 40 strikeouts in one season. And I was looking through his numbers to find out when that was. And in 1986, I think it was.
Correct.
He had 42 home runs and he struck out 38 times.
Okay, correct.
And then in 1989, he had 40 home runs and only struck out 37 times. And he won the Triple Crown in 1985, 37 homers, 130 RBIs, and hit .355. And he only struck out 33 times in that season. So just some remarkable numbers.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, what kind of company that puts him in. So
probably up there top. I know one season he hit, I think it's still a record, at least on Wikipedia it seems to still be a record, and that is in 1989 he hit into 34 double plays.
Wow.
Yeah, that's an awful lot, but he was a big guy, and he talks about, I can't remember if this was in the interview or not, but he talked about Ichiro and comparing himself in terms of hits. And he said, now, there's a guy with a lot of speed. So
right.
You can just imagine how much easier it was for him to get the ball on the ground and beat out hits. But he had a lot of hits in one particular year. I don't remember what year he was talking about, but maybe it was a team record. I think it was after. I shouldn't have even brought it up.
Or he batted in, you know, he's batted in the middle of a very big hitting order. I mean, big hitting, a very good offense. So there were always guys. I mean, this is, you know, he had a really impressive RBI total for one reason, that he had a lot. He hit, you know, he hit well, and he had a zillion guys on base in front of him. So, in fact, I'll tell you the one time I took my mom to an NPB game at Korakuen Stadium in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
The last year of Korakuen Stadium, I took her to see a day game between the Fighters and the Hankyu Braves. And we were sitting up in the cheap seats, and this kid, his dad and his son were watching the game, and Boomer grounded into a double play. And the son said, "Dad, foreign guys are so slow. He went, well, yeah, okay. Just by the way, the 7 times players have the 40 plus home runs and the fewer than 40 strikeouts. The guys are Hiromitsu Ochiai,
mm-hmm.
Boomer Wells twice, Sadaharu Oh once, Atsushi Nagaike, who was a predecessor of Boomer's with the Hankyu Braves in the early 70s, and Kaoru Beto, who was a great player. He was called he has often been called the Joe DiMaggio of Japan. So those are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys who have done it.
All right, so he's not the only guy, but he's one of just a select few who have done it. So that's pretty. What's that?
He's 1 of 5 and the only foreign registered player. So we'll get O out of there.
Okay, yeah, we have to do that. Yeah, all right. So also during the interview, Boomer made a mistake in saying a player named Shinagawa. I think he was having a Tokyo flashback moment there, and he meant to say Kunigasa. He meant to say Kinugasa. I put it down wrong. All right. So, yeah, he meant to say Kinugasa.
Sakyo Kinugasa, the Iron Man.
Yeah, and whose name I always mess up without fail. All right, so let's go ahead and take a listen to the interview. Our guest this week is Greg Boomer Wells. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
Now, what initially brought you to Japan? What was the impetus for your starting your career here? And what was your reaction to the baseball and the culture and the brand of baseball here? I mean, this is back in what year?
Well, it was at the end of 82, I think. And this next season, which was 83, when I came to Japan. But he sold me in 82 at the one of meetings.
My goodness.
And I found out after I got to Japan was that they told me that he had promised them me the year before when I was with Toronto.
Uh-huh.
So actually, he traded an everyday big league player for me and then didn't give me the opportunity to play in the big league, but sent me back to AAA and then sold me to Japan.
Wow.
Then tried to hike up the amount that they had agreed on because I'd had such a great year.
So you got here. You had a great career here. What was your initial reaction to the brand of baseball that they played here?
Really bother me. It was interesting, sort of funny, you know, as far as all the things, the little things that were going on, you know, on the side, so to speak.
For instance?
Horns and all that was, you know, I love the crowd. I've always enjoyed playing in front of a big crowd. I didn't care if it was 30, 40, 50,000 people cheering for me, 30, 40, 50,000 people cheering against me. I just like playing in front of the crowd. I like the noise. There was plenty of noise.
Right, there was. There still is.
So that was a great thing. And the brand of baseball, I played baseball from everywhere. So it was no big shock as far as the brand of baseball because I played in Venezuela before where they threw stuff at you on the field and all of that. So you had to have one eye on the hitter playing defense and one eye on the stands to keep somebody from hitting you in the head with a rock or something. So, you know, I enjoyed that, so I knew I was going to enjoy playing in Japan.
All right, so now there's been a lot of talk about the Hall of Fame, and do you think your career here was worthy of admission to the Hall of Fame?
Shinagawa with Hiroshima retired.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kadota. I can see Kadota. I'd say Kadota, Shinagawa, Yamamoto, Fukumoto, Yamada, Murata, Wilote, Suzuki. I'm just trying to pull the names of the people who were still playing when I came over there.
Mm-hmm.
I might have missed a couple of them. Besides those guys, I can't see anyone else. I can't see why anyone else would go in before me, let alone me not going in.
Right.
I mean, I made history. I did something that no other foreigner had ever done. I think, fourth in career batting average.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, I am first as far as right-handed hitters in career batting average in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
For everyone who has enough at bats to qualify. I still have records. I have the one record, the quickest to 1,000 hits, that's only been broken by Ichiro.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at his speed and my size, his size, my size, speed, and he didn't beat me by that many games. I think like 15 maybe.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, I can't see not being in the Hall of Fame over there. And I don't get what's the problem, but, you know, it's not my game.
Right.
All I could do was play as hard as I could play.
Why do you think the foreign membership in the hall here is nearly non-existent?
I think they only have one, right? That's Wally?
Well, Wally counts. They have Victor Starvin and Yonamine, and I guess you could count O, but that's about...
You could count O, but they really considered O a Japanese, so...
That's correct.
But, okay, Wally and Victor... I don't remember him. I've heard the name before. What did he do?
Yeah, he was a pitcher who won a whole bunch of games.
Okay, well, maybe. Did he win 300 games?
Yeah, I think so. He was born up in Hokkaido. He was basically Japanese, born and raised in Japan, but he had a passport that was not Japanese, so.
Okay, but he was born and raised in Japan, and he won 300 games.
Yeah.
So they couldn't keep him out. And they probably waited till the last minute to put him in. And my thing is that if they're going to put me in, I'd rather they put me in while I'm alive, because after I'm dead, I can't enjoy it. So, you know, I just don't get what's the problem. But like I said, it's not my game. I think that I've done enough to make it. And I don't know. I just have no idea what's the hold up.
Yeah, we've talked about it on the show before, about why there's so few foreigners in there, and we watch the vote and we hear about the votes and we wonder who's going to be the next foreigner admitted. So, turning to future now, if there was a player who was going to head to Japan for the first time, would your advice to them be different now than it would have been 25 years ago?
I would give them the same advice. The game has changed, though, but I would give them the same advice. It's not as bad as it used to be. The guys that are making all the money nowadays, basically, when I played, probably would have gotten released because their numbers wouldn't have been good enough to stay. So, you know, the strike zone is a lot fairer. They don't bother them as much as they did us. You know, it's just... It's a lot of different. The game is different, but I would give them the same advice.
And what would that advice be?
My advice would be to try to go along with the system, to remember that it is Japanese baseball, not American baseball. So you're not at home. You have to adjust to them. They don't have to adjust to you because it's their game. So you should try to adjust to their game rather than to try to make them adjust to you, and to work hard, get in the best shape possible to actually get in shape while you're old. I don't know how much they train now. We used to do a whole lot of training, so I used to always, after the season, I'd take 2 weeks off, and then I'd start training for the next season.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Japanese used to always say that I made the game look too easy. But what it was is that I prepared myself because I always wanted to be the best. So, like I said, I take 2 weeks off and then I started training for the next season. So when I showed up, I was always ready.
Right.
You know, I tell them to work hard so the game would be easy to them.
Now, did you get some advice before you came?
No, I talked to Charlie Manuel. Charlie just told me, Charlie used to tell me stories about what happened when he played over there, and I used to think he was just, you know, telling lies, just being funny and making me laugh while I was in the cage taking batting practice, and all the stuff came true. So I was like, I used to always say, Charlie, stop lying. And he'd go, you'll see, Boone, you'll see. And I never thought to ask him, why you keep telling me that you'll see? Maybe he knew something that I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But, and, you know, being spring training, I'd be hitting off the machine in the batting cage, you know, and he'd be behind the cage watching me hit and be talking, be telling me stories about when he played in Japan and stuff, and, you know, I just laugh, because I'm sitting there like, no way, Charlie, stop lying. And he kept saying, you'll see, and I saw, so...
What was one of the instances that you remember happening in Japan that you still carry with you today?
The one instance that I remember was he told me about how they were playing against the Tigers, I think. And so they were just beating the Tiger. They were lighting the pitcher up, just beating him up. And so they called timeout. And instead of coming out and changing the pitcher, they came out and changed the catcher. And I was like, whoa! Get out of here. You're just crazy. Stop lying. You're just crazy, man. That's funny. Stop acting crazy. And when I got to Japan, one of the first things that happened was we were, I want to say it was the Buffaloes, that we were beating pretty bad. And they called timeout, met up on the mound and stuff. And the next thing you know, they're changing catchers. And I just sit back and flash back to what Charlie had told me, and I just started laughing. I'm like, wow, he was telling the truth. And this catcher came in and shut us down, so I don't know, must have done something to it.
Maybe he had a good forkball, huh?
Well, see, this is the thing. That's another thing that I tell the guys that once they're over there, you know, when they ask me stuff, and I'll be like, you know, I don't know if it's the same game as it used to be, but you have to know what the pitcher throws, but you've got to know the catcher. And they go, you got to know the catcher. I go, yeah, you got to know the catcher because every catcher on that team pitches you differently. I say, when we played the Buffalo, the old guy had a pattern on how he pitched me. And I'd walk up to the plate not noticing who the catcher was sometime, and all of a sudden, it's a different pitch than what I'd be halfway expecting, and I'd step out and look back, and it's the young guy. So now you got to adjust your way of thinking again, like, okay, it's not the old guy, it's the young guy, so he's going to pitch me differently. So you got to change your strategy. You have to adjust. So I tell them to make sure they know the catcher plus the pitcher, but you got to make sure you know the catcher. I had a different way of hitting that I think my teammates and batting coaches and manager, you know, it was amazing to them, or it surprised them. My batting coach enjoyed it, I think, because it was not a whole lot of problems with him. He was one of the better batting coaches that I had in my career.
Mm-hmm.
In the States or in Japan.
What was his name? Do you remember?
His name was Sumitomo.
Okay.
He was one of the best batting coaches I've ever had. And I, if it was a pitcher that, you know, that I didn't know, I'd walk up to him. I didn't want to see a whole bunch of stuff. It was a new guy that I had never seen, had never faced before. I'd just walk up to him and go, Sumi, what does he throw? And he'd say, fastball, shoot toe, forkball, slider, curve. And then I'd ask him, what is his out pitch? And he'd say, forkball. So I knew what the guy threw. That's all I needed to know. And when he got two strikes, if his out pitch is a fork ball, he's going to throw his fork ball. And Sumi used to keep that. Whenever I go, what does he throw? And he'd tell me, and then he'd go, his out pitch is a fork ball. He got a really good fork ball. He has a really good slider, you know. So I know how to hit him. And then he would also, I didn't slump much, but if I found myself not hitting pitches that I usually would crush, I'd come back and ask Sumi Tomo. I go, Sumi, what am I doing? And he'd tell me, you're jumping at the ball, or you know, your hands are too high. You're in the biz, different things. But usually he would just give you, he wouldn't try to change you or nothing. He'd just go, you're jumping at the ball. Your hands are too high.
Right.
He'll just tell you, relax. Make him pitch to you.
Okay.
You know, and that's it. And I take that and I go up there and I use that. And I enjoyed that. There was no whole bunch of, lot of stuff. It was just that.
Sounds like you tried to keep it simple.
He did. He kept it very simple. And I tell guys all the time, hitting is very simple. You see the ball, you hit the ball. That's it. You know, little things in between that, but the most important thing is seeing the ball and hitting the ball. Baby, hitting is simple.
All right.
When it gets hard is when you add other stuff to it. And you make it a complex situation.
Right.
It's not that tough.
All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. We really appreciate you joining the show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And we're pulling for you. We always talk about the Hall of Fame, but we're always pulling for you. Hopefully we can get some changes made, and some of the guys who have come after you can hopefully get in, because we think they deserve it. But thank you for being on the show. All right, well, thank you again, Mr. Wells. It was really a pleasure to talk to you. I think you could get the sense that I was kind of in awe there. I just let him go.
Yeah, well, that's, you kind of have to do that with Boomer, because he's unique. He's a kind of a force of nature, and you know, I love every chance I get to talk to him. I haven't seen him in a few years, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, he was playing still when I got here, but I didn't really get to see much of him. Obviously, living in Nagoya, not too much of the Fighters, and didn't. I'm sorry, not the Fighters. No, it's Oryx. It's Blue Wave.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep track. All right, so I didn't get to see much of the Blue Wave, and I didn't get to see him with Dae all that much. But I did watch the news, and I did see highlights and flashes way back in the day when there wasn't all this technology to keep up with Japanese baseball. What jumped out at you specifically?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is the Hall of Fame. I love the quote on Victor Starfin, you know, all 300 wins, well, they couldn't keep him out. When I first heard Boomer's quote, it sounded like the purpose of the Hall of Fame was to keep people out. And I thought, well, that can't be true because there's so many players in it. But, you know, when I went back and looked at who's in the Hall of Fame and when they got there and how they were put in there, you'll see that essentially the Hall of Fame is a bunch of old guys who had very little to do with playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
Administrators, executives, and then managers, umpires, inspirational leaders, and then there's kind of a trickle of the greatest of the greats and some old guys who did historic things. So the number of players are pretty darn few. It's only been kind of a recent trend that players who were just very, very good players have gotten into the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big stars, because it used to be just the Nagashimas and O's and Nomuras and so on. If you weren't a big manager, it was very hard to get just pretty good managers, a lot of, you know, kind of interesting owners, founders.
Right.
Are in there. But players is pretty few.
Yeah. And I mean, he was a really high impact import player. I think, you know, he had a lot of impact on the games. You heard him talking about, you know, him saying that the game came easy for him. And obviously, you can hear the level of, not disgust, and maybe angst in his voice about it. I mean, it seemed like he really wanted to be in there, and he doesn't want to be he doesn't want to be a posthumous entry. You know, he wants to be able to enjoy it.
Be posthumous, you know. Nobody wants to be posthumous.
I can understand that. That there's not much fun there, not much partying in your casket. But yeah, I mean, I could just feel how much, especially when he talked about how he got ready in the winter. He only took 2 weeks off. I mean, these guys really devote themselves to their craft, and you see how much it means to him. And so he knows he made an impact here.
Hmm.
And he's hoping that at least, you know, he says in one breath, he says, it's not my game, I understand. But in the next breath, he says he hopes he can enjoy it. So hopefully the what is it, the experts committee?
Right, the special committee.
That's put together just gives him that acknowledgement and gets him in there. I'd love to see him be part of the Hall of Fame. It'd be nice.
He's in a group of players. Was he a historic figure? You could say he was the first foreigner to win a triple crown in Japan. Was he a great player on a great team? Yeah, he was a great player on a great team. You know, it's just hard to say. If he was universally loved and a tragic figure, he was well liked and well respected.
Well respected, exactly.
He wasn't tragic, you know. You know, so far we had like Tsunemi Tsuda, who died of cancer at a very young age, and I think he's in the Hall of Fame. And it's hard to see. I mean, there's so many great players in Japan who aren't there and should be there. They just elect so few.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard for him to get in there, not because he's not deserving, just because the way the system is.
Right. Right. Now, he touched on a number of other intriguing topics, including playing in Venezuela, where people would throw things at the players. And I thought that was something that obviously helped him adjust to being, you know, a foreign player here.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, I think that's a big thing here. I think one of the things that a lot of the most successful foreign players are guys who have a lot of experience playing in foreign countries that they come to Japan. And I think a lot of Latin players do well here because if they've had any kind of success in the U.S., they've had success in a foreign country, in a foreign culture where the language isn't their own and where the rules aren't the ones they're used to. So that's a big thing.
Yeah. Now, another thing he mentioned was talking about the catchers, and I thought that was something that I obviously have heard and talked about with Alex Ramirez, and that the concept of knowing the catchers is very important, and Alex always talks about that. And, you know, the story he talked about, obviously bringing in a new catcher when the pitcher was getting beaten up, was just made me laugh.
That's a Japanese thing. There's a great story from Nate Minchie. You know, when he was with the Marines, and the manager then, Koji Yamamoto, came out and screamed at the catcher for calling a curveball that Minchie hung and got hit for a home run. Didn't hang the curveball, man.
Yeah, the catcher, obviously, I think I said it, the catcher doesn't have a good forkball.
Indeed.
Now, the other thing that he said that made my jaw kind of bounce off of the floor was that hitting is simple.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, man, not for me. It never, see the ball hit the ball. I've got a great set of eyes, man. I have no problem seeing it zip past me for a strike.
Well, good for him. Yeah, more power to you, Boomer. It's easy. I think it's a skill that, you know, some people can master, and he's certainly one of the masters. And you know, the whole thing about how he came to Japan was fairly enlightening. he told me that one before. I didn't know that he had been acquired so that he could be sold. I knew that he had issues with the teams he played for that are pretty typical of the ones guys come to Japan, in that they come to Japan for playing time. In his case, he wasn't going to get playing time in the majors because they always had somebody who was performing worse than him, but who had more political clout and had more cachet within the organization. This happens all the time. And those guys so often come to Japan, whether they're sold here or they're trying to swim here, they get here.
Yeah, obviously you could hear the disgust in his voice right off the bat. But I guess that wasn't a major issue, selling players for cash and the rights to players for cash. That really hasn't been an issue for a long time, I thought.
No, well, it's still, I mean, well, it's the selling the players' contracts happens all the time. I mean, selling the players' contract is happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's usually with players who want to come to Japan. you couldn't really, I think you couldn't say, you couldn't blackball a player for not playing in Japan when his rights were sold there, because that would be, you couldn't get by with that.
Mm.
Because, it'd just be a violation of every known labor law.
Right.
Well, baseball really cares too much about labor laws, but, you know, that's another thing. Yeah.
But it turned out to be a good thing for him, so... Obviously,
sure.
Yeah. The way, the method, and the route was not good, but the result was very good.
Yeah.
I think.
Great. He had a tremendous career here that would have been really hard to latch onto in the States, and that goes for a lot of guys. Not that he couldn't have been. He could have. There's no doubt in my mind that Boomer and Randy Bass, who are contemporaries, and you know, and Pepe Rhodes could have had a major league career. But their careers just happened to be here where they got the chances.
Mm-hmm.
They were ready to take those chances.
Yeah, and after the interview, Boomer talked about the fact that some teams actually showed some interest once he started to be productive over in Japan. But he actually would have played for free, but the offers that they were making were just, they weren't comparable.
Well, they weren't for free. Wanted him to play for free, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, Tyrone Woods told me the same thing. He said, hey, he had what I considered to be an MVP season in 2006 with the Dragons. He had some offers some interest for some teams, but they were never able to lure him over. He said, hey, no, I'm good. You know, you enjoy playing here. So it worked out good for both those guys.
That's the thing. When you're established here, you're worth more. And as far as I know, I've looked at it, as far as I know, a lot of major league players have gone on and been regulars in the, after leaving Japan. Terry Whitfield was the first that I remember, but, Terry Whitfield got a contract. Lee Stevens had a pretty good career after leaving Japan. A lot of position players have done that, but they all, they all have to go through spring training invites. I don't think anybody's ever got a guaranteed major league contract based. No position player has ever got a guaranteed major league contract based on, you know, being an outstanding player in Japan.
Yeah, Cecil Fielder was the guy who is, I think, the best example of that, because he went back and was really successful.
He was. I forgot Cecil because he was only here for a short time.
Yeah.
But yes, he was. He was a great example.
Okay. At any rate, thank you very much, Boomer, for the chat. We really appreciate it. And he's back in Georgia, he says. He's retired. He does some clinics once in a while. So keep up the good work. Help those kids get the fundamentals down.
Get them, teach them how to hit, babe.
Yeah, see the ball, hit the ball, kid. Get it done. All right, moving on to our next topic, the trade of the century, you want to call it?
It's probably the biggest trade in probably 5-6 years, I would think.
Yeah, let's see now. The Nippon Ham Fighters kick out of their program. They just throw a guy out the door, Yoshio Itoi, and then throw in Tomoyo Yagi,
right.
A pitcher, left-hander, and they send him to Oryx for Hiroshi Kisanuki, a pitcher, Keiji Obiki, a shortstop, mainly shortstop and an infielder, and then the remains of Shogo Okada, who's an outfielder, slash pinch hitter. Shocked me when I saw it come over the,
Yeah, that was, I came home and I'm going, that was, the WTF moment.
Very nice, very nice. We will allow that on the show. Keeping it R rated or less than PG-13. I didn't know what to think, and I saw it come over, and then I saw someone write something on Twitter, and someone sent me an email, and it just started to blow up, and I'm like, they're asking me why, and the only thing I could think of is his face, his expression, and the Nikon article that I looked at said that he had he had agreed to his contract, which was $280 million or $240 million, somewhere around there. I don't remember the exact number. And then, but his face during that press conference, and I'm not sure if he agreed or not, because I just remember seeing something on the news about them talking about this would be the offer. But I think he agreed to it, right?
No, as far as I know, he has not signed.
He hasn't even signed it. Okay. And, but his face is the level of disgust and utter hatred. He says, yes, I'm going to sign, or I agree, or whatever. Maybe he agreed to it, but they haven't done the final.
Well, that won't. I won't say this. He had held out. He'd had, as far as I know, the situation was, he had two meetings. He met the team twice in December, and both times they tried to push on him a contract. This is according to the media, which sometimes gets the details wrong because it's often the numbers are sort of shadowy. But what was reported in Kyoto was that he was offered a 10 billion yen raise to 200 million. So to go from 190 million to 200 million. And that was given to him twice without a raise. And after that, his agent came and he did not. That was the schedule for a third meeting in January, which I never heard any details about. So, that was supposed to be early in January, like the 6th. And here's the trade. Now, here's the other thing about this deal. The two other stories about this trade, or at least one is a story and one's just something that happened. The other part of the story is that he demanded to be posted after the 2013 season.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted that. And, okay, now what else is in this interesting is why these players, why this group of players is kind of interesting. The only thing I can think about is Kisanuki, because you have to wonder. Kisanuki was also a holdout for the most of December, and he did get a better raise than the first one they offered him. But I wonder if there wasn't some unpleasantness involved there.
And yeah,
we'll take yours if you take ours.
Mm. Well, I mean, on the surface is what I looked at when I saw the trade, and they said a 2-for-3 trade, and I'm like, well, you're kidding me, right? It's a 2-for-1.5. It's 1.5 men. I mean, Okada is not going to.
It's 3 half players for a really, really good player and a half a player. I'll give Obiki is the only player in that going to Nippon Ham who really has any value. And, it's not much. I mean, he'll basically replace, he's 28 years old, which is about 10 years younger than their captain, Makoto Kaneko. But, so he would be a 28-year-old no-hit shortstop replacing a 38-year-old no-hit shortstop, which sounds like a good deal, except Kaneko isn't the shortstop because he can't hit and he can't field much. He's a shortstop because he's Kaneko. He's a tremendous team leader. He's a presence. Now, you can't be a presence when you hit 200, but, Obiki, Kaneko is a big team leader, and Obiki isn't.
Right, and Kaneko, I mean, he's had flashes in the past three to five seasons where he's had really good stretches offensively, and Obiki's nowhere near that offensively, and defensively, I don't think he's that. He's going to have better range, but I don't see it. I don't see it in the field. He's just an average shortstop to me.
I think Obiki is an improvement in the field, but he doesn't have a couple of the little extras that I like with Kaneko. Shogo Okada, what it was like, let's make a deal. They got the pick. What was beyond door number two? I mean, it's just amazing. It's a big salary dump. It's a big salary dump for the fighters. Here's the thing: if they were going to post him, they could have, the fighters could have said, well, we could post you right now.
Mm-hmm.
We could post you today and see how that goes. But the thing is, he's 31 years old. And if he were 27, they could make, they pick up a million or a couple million dollars off of him. Right now, they wouldn't get much, even they wouldn't even get money, Japanese money for him. So. Right. they might as well get, okay, they'll get some depth at the infield. They'll get a pitcher who might be okay, who might do, well, I have to think that every Oryx pitcher will do better away from Oryx. And with Fighters defense behind him? Yeah. Yeah, just give us an arm. You know, it's like, pick, okay, here's the guy who doesn't want to sign his contract, so give me, you can keep on him.
And that's why I think Kisanuki is going to be, at the very least, he'll be serviceable, and he might just be an adequate starter for them because he's going to be in that dome, and he's going to have that defense behind him. He's going to be maybe a little bit better, maybe another, instead of pitching five innings, maybe he can even go six for you, and that's, you know, going to say, or you can use him as a reliever. That's the other option. I thought they might want to have him as a reliever. But
he's done before?
Yeah, he's got experience of that. But, you know, they lost Kensuke Tanaka. I just think they wanted some backup on the infield, somebody with some experience. And they're going to mix and match, I think, maybe at that point. But what are they going to do in the outfield was the other thing. And maybe I thought, okay, they're going to open up that spot for Ohtani to play in the outfield and pitch every fifth day.
That's not out of the realm of possibility. It's something that, you know, I'd love to see just because it's different. I would so much love to see that. It's a really hard thing to do. It's a brutally hard thing to do, but, and it hasn't, this is not something that has worked, I don't know if it's ever worked in Japanese baseball, in the two league system. This is something that probably last worked in the major leagues, back in the 20s. You know, the Giants, New York Giants and New York Yankees, had guys who would be first, a common one was first baseman and pitcher. So, guys who would pinch hit and play first base and then, you know, once a week they'd go out and pitch. So, I'd love to see it. I think the other thing is they've also got Ugamori who can really hit. I mean, he's not, Itoi's, you could argue that Itoi right now is the best player in the Pacific League. And I don't know you'd be right or wrong, but you could certainly argue that.
Well, you know me, I've had a man crush on him since.
I don't want to talk about your private life, John, but, well, I do, but I don't know if this is the time or place. But anyway, he's a great player. He's been the Fighters' best hitter for three of the last 4 years. And the first was, he's a tremendous outfielder. It's hard to see, you know, how do you get rid of guys like that? I mean, it boggles the imagination. Unless you're going to dump salary and you figure, I don't know. It's still a mystery even after all that.
Yeah, I mean, on an everyday basis, I mean, you're picking up three guys who can't help, none of them is going to help you every day. And without Itoi, you know, doing what he did for you, and I actually championed him as a possible MVP candidate for last season, and it just, I don't get it, but we'll see how it plays out. I'm glad for Oryx because I'm tired of them being so bad and finishing at the bottom or near the bottom or out of the playoffs. So it looks like a big coup for them. They've picked up a lot of talent in this offseason.
They have, and they're going to have a heck of an offense especially if Takahiro Okada figures out his swing. Sakaguchi, if he can come back, that's a heck of an offense.
Yeah. Maybe we can expect some good things. Maybe they'll flip-flop places.
Another thing they had is, you know, now of course Oryx's issue is they still don't, they've got two second basemen. They don't have a shortstop. They've got essentially four starting outfielders. It's kind of a mismatch, but, yeah, that's Oryx for you. If their pitchers are healthy, which they weren't at all last year,
mm-hmm.
and not messing around with them, which they haven't been able to do, although Moriwaki, you know, is a new guy, the new manager, they could be really good. I mean, you and I both, I mean, every year we talk about Oryx saying this is a team we really like if they weren't Oryx.
Yeah. Interesting. Good luck to them. Good luck to the Fighters. Now, another interesting addition or a newcomer to Japan was the Yokohama Bay Stars picked up Niger Morgan or Tony Plush or Tony Plush? Morgan or Nigel Plush. I don't know.
Tony Plush.
Somebody with a lot of personality. I don't know how much.
Tony Tombstone. That's another one. He's got. You should check his webpage. Check Nigel Morgan's webpage. He hasn't updated it recently, but it's a hoot.
All right. Well, I like him. He has a lot of energy, if nothing else. Now, you know, he had an incident in the outfield where he didn't pick up a ball. I think this was either last season or the season before, and he wasn't able to catch a ball. I think it was the season before. I think it was with the Nats. And he didn't catch a ball, and he kind of threw a tantrum, and the ball ended up, it wasn't out of the park, it was behind him, and while he was throwing the tantrum, he didn't pick it up and throw it. I mean, you know, stuff. Not bad stuff. And then he's got the alter ego Tony Plush, but you know, Lastings Millage had his issues, and he came here last year, and he was very respectful and kept his nose down and worked hard, and he had a really good season, and, I'm really hoping that Nigel Morgan can do the same thing. Batting in the three hole, I don't know if he's a number three hitter per se. I don't know if you want to put a lot of pressure on a guy like that who's just coming to Japan. And they're going to actually have a really nice looking lineup, if you ask me. I mean, they didn't get Fukudome, but this is probably better.
Yeah, I think Fukudome is, I think he and Nigel Morgan are kind of interesting. They're probably not that far apart, except Morgan has more upside. But being a foreigner, he's also got the downside is sometimes you bring the horse to water and they just don't want to drink. You know, they just go home. So every time it's a little roll of the dice, but, they gotta have the most fun team in Japan in terms of entertainment. Him and Nakahata and Morimoto.
You see Ramirez teaching him some dance when he hits a home run, you know, you do this and I'll do that. And they'll be working on their dance moves.
Could do. I want to see Nigel Morgan interviewing Nakahata without an interpreter.
That would be funny. All right, now we also have camps opening on February 1st, and I'm sure this is the third season that we're doing a podcast, so you all will know how I feel about opening camp when players are bundled up like Kenny from South Park, and there's snow everywhere.
There's snow everywhere here. They don't camp as, I'll just to clarify things, the teams that used to camp in Kochi Prefecture where they did have snow now and then, don't anymore until after like, February 20th when it's still cold. So snow is not a problem, but it's still cold and windy and rainy in Miyazaki and it's cool and rainy in Okinawa. So unless you're the Marines in Ishigaki, tropical Ishigaki, you're in for some cold weather.
Well, those guys are still swathed in winter garb. It's ridiculous. And plus it's February 1st. It's too long. And, you know, I don't like camp, but this year with the WBC coming up in March, I think camp is going to, the fact that it's starting now is going to actually help. And it's a good thing.
Well, of course, it's always the thing about Japan is that the camp starts early, and I think with the, you know, I've said this probably more times than anybody cares to hear, is I think this is one of the fact that they play the WBC in March, and two things, Japanese teams start camp on the 1st of February instead of the 15th, and the plan in Japan is to be at close to your peak on opening day. It's the Red Auerbach Celtic theory, which is get the first game counts as much as the last game. The only problem is it's Japan, so they kind of get carried away and they kind of forget about the last game. So they're primed for the beginning of the season. So they're a little better off than most of their opposition at the beginning of the season. But anyway, this is camp. We do have the WBC. The players are going to be leaving. In fact, a couple of players aren't even showing up for camp because they're going to be in the WBC.
Nice. Well, let's talk about the WBC now. Now, let me preface this next statement by saying I'm not necessarily rooting for Japan. I'm rooting for the U.S. and maybe the Dominican Republic. But I expect Japan to contend very well in this tournament, and the same goes for South Korea. Now, this was right after the the provisional rosters were announced, ESPN, which a place I go daily to get my sports news, had on the Sweet Spot blog by Dave Schoenfield a level of disrespect for Asian baseball that I really didn't think still existed. He basically went through and counted the number of major league players on the provisional rosters that were announced and said, well, this team has two, so they're not going to be very good. And this team is made up of, obviously the U.S. team is made up of all major league players, so we're going to be good. And ranked all the teams, and he ranked Japan fourth. This is a two-time defending champion. And then South Korea, he ranked seventh. So I was pretty much disgusted.
What did he rank Cuba?
I don't remember. And maybe I wrote it down here. I don't remember. I wanted to read it all, and I was just, I kept, as I read, the more I read, the more my blood boiled, because, like I said, I'm rooting for the United States, and I want them to win, but, no Mike Trout, no Justin Verlander, no a lot of guys who are really big stars, and the thing is, he counted the major leaguers, but when Japan won, both times there were guys who were future major leaguers on the rosters. Daisuke Matsuzaka was on there, Fukudome played, Iwakuma pitched, Yu Darvish. What's he thinking? So I was thinking, hey, look, call your buddies, get them to get a hold of some people and do some research. Now there's Michael Westbay, there's Wayne Grosick, there's Jim Allen, and I'll even throw myself in there, and then there's Jason Cosgrove. Get somebody on the phone and do some homework. Don't just make this stuff up based on how many big leaguers are on the roster.
Well, Jason Stark has a nice thing on ESPN's site talking about the WBC, and he's basically his research, and I haven't tried to duplicate Jason Stark's research, but he said basically, what are these people afraid of? And I guess they're afraid of, a lot of guys are afraid of injuries, but the news, according to Jason Stark's belief, and I'm not quite certain it's exactly on the money, he said your chances of getting hurt are better if you just go to camp than if you go to the WBC. But they're essentially the same. If you play baseball, some guys are going to get hurt. If you're practicing, some guys are going to get hurt. So anyway, he was saying, well, you know, if that's the case, the big guys should be going so they can take part and not miss the show, and which I agree with. There have been guys who got hurt in the WBC, no doubt about it. I don't think Dontrell Willis was ever as good as he was after 2006, but I don't know if that was the WBC or something else. But anyway, as far as research goes, yeah, that was kind of poor. It was sort of like, well, we're in America, so we only know about America. And besides, if you looked at the provisional rosters, Japan's provisional roster had Atsunori Inaba as the only outfielder. So that team probably wouldn't have had trouble competing against the United States.
You mean it would have had trouble, I think, yeah.
But that was just because the provisional rosters are, I really don't understand what their purpose is, because they're not naming teams. They used to name like 40 guys that they could make a roster out of, but now they were allowed to name up to, I think, 26.
Mass confusification.
It's for PR purposes, I suppose.
Yeah, but I didn't like what ESPN did, and I'm hoping that Asia shows well in the tournament. And like I said before, I'm not saying that Japan's going to win or going to lose. I think the team is going to perform fairly well, and you know that doesn't always show up in the results in a tournament where if you lose a game or two, you're out. So I mean, it's amazing that they've won these first two. They always get ready early in starting because camp's on February 1st when there's snow everywhere in Tokyo and other places, not Okinawa and the other places. But, I mean, they get ready early. They're prepared. They're ready to play. And they do perform well. But to just rank teams based on the number of major league players, I think that was pretty lazy work. And like I said, we're offering our services for free here. Just give us a call.
Well, the only thing I would say is I think it'll be easier for the U.S. To get here than it will be there, than it will be for Japan, just because the way they've done the WBC groups this time is to put all three of the former of the finalists and of the previous finalists are all going to be playing the second round in Tokyo. So we've got it's going to have Japan and Cuba and South Korea and probably the Netherlands who were quarterfinalists last time are going to probably be playing the second round in Tokyo. In the second round in the U.S., the Dominican Republic didn't get very far because the Dutch beat them twice.
Yeah, it's pretty shady too. How the U.S. is always in this weak group and has an easy path, and they lose to teams like Canada, which Canada actually has a really good team this year. I mean, a lot of major league players on it.
Speaking of a lot of players, there are 30 players in this on the provisional rosters they announced the other day who have played in NPB.
30 people. So keep that in mind, Mr. ESPN Sweet Spot bloggers.
It's about five of them who are playing for Brazil. It used to be minor leaguers with the Yakult Swallows, but we'll just get over that one.
Okay. All right. We'll jump over that and go straight to fielding questions. All right. So, as I calm down here and wipe the sweat from my brow, we had a question last time from Dave in Oregon. He sent us a softball, which we did on the last show, and he sent us a hardball. And this is part two. And I had to cut it down to keep it within the 1 minute time limit, but here we go. I'm reading excerpts from his letter. He said, "There's a lot of discussion about PEDs right now with Lance Armstrong and the recent Hall of Fame. This is the U.S. for Hall of Fame ballots being collected in Cooperstown. While it is convenient to pretend the era of dirty ball is over, that simply isn't the case." Now, Dave went on to discuss Munenori Kawasaki, who was in nearby Seattle. Obviously, it's nearby Oregon. Last year with the M's, with the Seattle Mariners, and he faced a guy, Bartolo Colon, who was suspended last year when he was caught for doping. Dave said Kawasaki went 1-for-4 in that game versus Bart, and I call him Big Bart. But Dave asks, what have you observed over the years? Could it be argued that Kaz Matsui and others would have had better careers in a clean league? And have any Gaijin players expressed disgust that their chances in the U.S. were spoiled by drug-enhanced opponents? Whew.
Well, would they have had a better chance playing in the U.S.? I guess they would have had a better chance if they'd used PEDs. The fact is that, you know, they're competing with everybody else who either is or isn't using, and it doesn't, I would say now they're competing with people who aren't using against a few players who are, and everybody's got to face the same, you know, face that situation. Would it matter in the case of Kawasaki? The answer is, I would say no. Matsui maybe, but Matsui had other issues.
Yeah. My answer to the questions are no and no. I mean, I've never thought to ask any imports who come to Japan if they thought the playing field wasn't level stateside because of PEDs. And I've also never considered asking Japanese players about the PED aspect in the States. Now, I don't know if we can assume that it's an unfair or not level playing field. I think the testing methods in the States have improved, and it's harder to cheat. That's my opinion. Kawasaki, I think he was what he was. I don't think I said when we talked about it on the show, we had a question last year, you know, Kawasaki going to do? I said, I think he's a non-roster spring training invitee who's going to get a chance to play and maybe be a pinch runner defensive replacement. And that's exactly what he was. And he had a great season. He won a job out of spring because he hit so well.
If you can hit as well as he can, there's some team in the major leagues that can find a job for you.
Right. And as for Matsui, I think, he was what he was. I think he had a very adequate career for the kind of player he was. In fact, I think he might have even overachieved a little bit in the United States. I don't think he was a great player. He didn't have a great swing. He had a good swing. He doesn't have a great arm. You talked about the fact that he has other issues.
The other issues are I think a lot of the Japanese guys have trouble with is the contact at second base.
Yeah. Yeah, defense was the big issue, I think, for him. But offensively, he surprised me. I really expect him to have as much pop as he did.
Well, that didn't surprise me. I think he could have done quite a bit better had he not been in New York. But as far as, you know, did that impact his career? I really doubt it, because if it was hard on him, it was hard on everybody. You know, if it was hard on Kawasaki, it's hard on everybody. If it's easier on Kawasaki, it's easier on everybody. I don't see how it's really relevant to the issue. Now, as far as foreign players, I can't say, but I did, Marty Brown essentially said that he was in a position when he was a young player that in the minors that he had a wife and kids, and he could not, because of his family, he was not in a position where he could use PEDs because he felt he was afraid of the long-term health effects. And he said that he had to compete for playing time with players who were not so encumbered. And he mentioned a player, but I don't want to say his name because I don't want to. We had this conversation 6 or 7 years ago. And I might not remember it well enough, but basically he was in the same organization with this guy who became a fairly good star, although he was a couple of, he's a couple of rungs, or at least a rung ahead of him in the minor league, picking order with that club. So, so I think there was that issue that certainly, I don't know about the steroids use in Japan. I mean, there have been talk about players. And, but right now we have the testing in Japan, and so it's pretty thorough here too. There's a random testing after games, as anybody who's, you know, occasionally they get the guy who's going to do the hero interview, and the PR guy comes out and said, sorry, he'll be 15 minutes late because he's peeing into a cup.
Yeah. Yeah. I asked around on this one. I asked some of the reporters in, obviously the Yomiuri reporters, and I asked some of my friends, and I think, most of them came back with the same thing that, you know, the testing in Japan, the random testing in Japan after games is kind of lenient, because it is so random that you never know when you're going to get hit, and some guys go through the whole season and never get tested. So that could be a little more strict to get some of the cheaters out, but I think the non-cheaters, they know the playing field is basically it's level. The other asking around I did with some other reporters, they said, hey, look, Japanese guys, all they did was, you know, they're Japanese reporters. They said, well, these guys are Japanese players. The image that I have of them is not these big bulky guys who hit home runs. And so I don't think they're using. and I thought, well, that's, you know, it's like boulder dash. I'm like, well, they could be using something to heighten their energy level, or they could be using something to keep.
Well, there have been Japanese players who had mysterious improvements in power and decreases in power after the steroids became an issue. So, and I'm not going to name names for lack of evidence, but there have been a few people who have been associated with steroids obtusely or abstractly, or, you know, in rumors,
right.
Whether any true or not, I can't say.
And the Japanese players we have had questioned recently were Kazuki Yoshimi, the garlic shots he took back in 2007, I think it was, 6 or 7, and then Hirokazu Ibata of the Dragons, who had the eye medication.
Right.
And then obviously we've had 3 foreign guys who are pop for drug use, and that was Rick Gutterson in 2007 with the Hawks, and then the same year Luis Gonzalez of the Giants, and then Daniel Rios of the Swallows. I'm sorry, Gonzalez and Rios and the Swallows were hit in or caught in 2008.
Right.
Rick Gutterson was the first player to be caught caught for some kind of drug, and it was basically what they said was a masking agent. It was some hair tonic thing. So I mean, I don't know, maybe some players are using some substances that are on the bandwagon. But I know you like that, but it's mostly speculation. Go ahead.
The time delay fuse on that joke.
That's a firecracker that just keeps popping.
Okay.
But yeah, I think the playing field is fair in both places. I'm not sure how much guys are cheating. I don't know how much we can say they're cheating. I know that Bud Selig was really happy recently with himself with the HGH testing that they are going to implement in the States, and I expect Japan to follow suit because Japan does follow suit a lot of times right after the major leagues does something. They do follow suit sometimes, and so I expect them to do the same, and hopefully they'll improve the situation.
No, I think things are getting under control. So as far as that goes, it's sort of like the way the testing's done now. It's almost impossible the way they keep samples. It's very hard to imagine that. You know, if you're ahead of the curve, that you 2 years later they might not catch you.
Yeah.
So, you know, now they're turning up drug cheats from the Athens Olympics. So, that's certainly the future. Is the way everything's. You know, they're going to keep the samples, and if there's something there that shouldn't have been there, then they're going to catch you.
Strike three, you're out.
Well, like baseball.
Yep. And with that, we are out too. Please, if you have any questions or comments, send them via MP3 or just an email. Send it to yakyujohn@gmail.com and we'll play them or read them on the show. You can also leave us a comment on the Facebook page, which we had a lot of activity this week with the trades and everything else. So, thank you very much. We will have another show in 2 weeks and, we'll appreciate you listening then. Enjoy your winter vacation.